Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA.
Going to the university and getting $200,000 in debt and having a philosophy major, it makes you smarter. I mean, and no one says that that is not the case, but you are not career ready, and there's jobs for philosophers these days.
Is high school focusing enough on preparing kids for high-skilled manufacturing jobs? Find out later in the show. Before we get to that, though, the long-awaited Expo Line extension to Santa Monica opens this weekend. It's the culmination of 20 years of work by activists, legislators, and transportation planners and engineers. Here's one of them.
Hi, my name is Francie Steffen. I'm the City of Santa Monica Mobility Manager.
So you, as much as anybody, must be excited about this Friday.
I am absolutely thrilled about this Friday opening of the Expo Line. It's been many years coming, and this is a transformative moment for Santa Monica, the region, and the entire metro network. Santa Monicans will be able to get downtown now in 46 minutes. And it's really going to be wonderful for people who are getting to their homes east of Santa Monica or who want to come on the weekend to go to the beach and don't want to sit on the 10 westbound anymore and don't want to pay for parking or don't even really want to worry about it. It's going to be wonderful to just get off the train in your flip-flops, walk down the beautiful new Colorado Esplanade and straight to the pier or walk up to downtown. I think people have no idea how fun that's going to be on a Saturday and a Sunday.
LA is hugely spread out. The transit system is growing, but its tentacles do not penetrate every neighborhood by any stretch. For many people, it's still a distance from home or work to, say, the Expo Line. How do you persuade that person to try the system?
Yes, first and last mile connections, like you're describing, are really important. And we know that people are going to be dropped off by loved ones, but they're also going to take a bus to the connecting train. They might walk if they're within walking distance, or they might use Breeze Bike Share. That'll take you about 2 miles pretty comfortably to and from the station in Santa Monica, which will get you to anywhere within the city of Santa Monica. The nice thing is there's also many private sector investments that are happening. We see different rideshare companies like Uber and Lyft. We see other ones in the country like Bridge and Chariot. These are providing critical first last mile services for people where maybe the train isn't the most convenient option, but with a little bit of help from a private sector company, they can get to where they need to be.
You've just laid out how one can kind of manage the first last mile. And in principle, it all sounds great. But in practice, it really does take time, especially when one is navigating streets that are absolutely filled with cars. How do you persuade people that the time spent making all those connections is time well spent?
Well, I think the really important thing to remember is that people want their time back to make it productive again. The time they're spending in their cars right now, we need to be alert because we need to be safe on the streets. So that's why not texting and driving is so important. The second you start to change that into a biking trip or a walking trip, you're now integrating exercise as part of your day. Or if you're on the bus or the train, you have that time to check your email, to catch up with friends that you're riding with. You are effectively getting that time back in your day. It's not time lost, it's time gained.
Do you yourself use the transit system to get here or from your home, or are you anticipating doing so?
I sure am. I plan on using the train all the time. In fact, I ride Metro right now frequently. Currently, I ride the Expo bike and ped path to work every single day. And I watch the test trains happily. I wave at the conductors, and I'm really excited some days when it's raining or I don't feel like riding my bike to hop on that train and take it right to work.
That was Francie Steffen. She's mobility manager for the City of Santa Monica. While many Angelenos are revving up for the first train to the beach in over 60 years, some transit dreamers are working on a vehicle that would leave light rail in the dust. That was the reaction to a test last week for the fledgling Hyperloop, the proposed transit in a tube that would propel you between LA and San Francisco in half an hour. The test was conducted by a group of engineers from LA company Hyperloop One on a dusty desert site in Nevada. But what was it supposed to demonstrate? The company's CEO is Rob Lloyd.
The test was of an electric motor that actually is used to propel the pod very quickly in the Hyperloop system. So it was very successful. We went very quickly. It was an outdoor test, not inside the tube, which will be the eventual architecture that we'll continue to build and actually have a complete demonstration of the system by the fourth quarter of this year. In the Hyperloop that we'll construct as the summer begins and then complete towards the end of the year, there will be no rail. We actually use levitation to lift the pod, which you could think of as an airplane or a vehicle of some sort without wings. It's levitated using a magnetic levitation. It's propelled using the motor that we demonstrated. And then we put it inside a tube to remove the actual air pressure, which removes resistance. So as a result of that architecture, you can move very quickly. We use very little energy, and we can actually explore new routes in urban areas.
Even if the Hyperloop works exactly as you've described, how do you embed it into the cities at either end?
Well, our expectation is that we are going to use existing right-of-ways, creatively finding ways to gain access to very high-density transportation areas. I actually live in Santa Monica, so I'm very familiar with the new Metro line and looking forward to riding it. And its design is to stop frequently along the route, as it includes many different locations. The Hyperloop, because of the nature of its speed and the nature of its design, would only go to one destination. So if I got in a pod, for example, in Santa Monica, I would only stop at my final destination, which could be downtown LA, or it could be the Union Station.
Hyperloop One is one of several teams that have joined the global race to see if they can realize the idea originally floated by Elon Musk. It's a concept that captures the imagination, and not always in a good way. One listener described the high-speed tube travel as, quote, a guaranteed heart attack for older folk on Medicare. But Hyperloop One's Rob Lloyd says not to worry, it'll feel like being on an airplane. So how viable is Hyperloop? Do we need it? If it took 20 years and complex political wrangling to build the Expo line, what chance does an independent new system have? Jeff Wardle heads Graduate Transportation Systems and Design at Arts Centre, and he co-founded Urban Systems Labs, which helps bridge public and private sectors when it comes to building large-scale infrastructure.
I would say essentially that there is no shortage of vision at any level of the transportation spectrum. But when it comes to getting advanced transportation systems off the ground, so as to speak, there are definitely some challenges. Certainly in this part of the world, there's a lack of political will, certainly at a national level, if you like, to really put the money behind large infrastructural and transportation projects. Definitely seems to be that things have to grow more from a grassroots level now. There's the other big question when it comes to advanced transportation is who actually gets to pay? Coming up with a vision is really easy. Well, perhaps not quite that easy, but it's one of the easier parts, coming up with the ideas. But figuring out who's going to get to pay for it is always a big, big question when it comes to transportation, which is really expensive. And then this is no trivial matter either. The other issue is once you've decided you're going to build a new transportation system, there's the question of the rights of way. Where are you actually going to place this? And it was interesting, actually, you know, following the Santa Monica extension, that everybody supported that until they found out that it might actually go past their backyard, and then there was a sort of change of attitude. So there's always a struggle to get the rights of way sorted out. And then, of course, there are a lot of regulatory issues as well, which become a big challenge.
In terms of the levels of innovation and experimentation, there clearly is a disjunction between private and public. I mean, the Expo line is great, but it isn't the most advanced looking or acting transit system. In much of the country, transit systems are crumbling. You go to New York, you know, one of the greatest cities in the world, and one goes on this rickety old subway. But then in our backyard, we have Tesla, we have Apple, you know, we have this incredible innovation. And here we have a bunch of maverick inventors trying to get this Hyperloop off the ground.
Sure.
So it seems to be that it's sort of in the private sector that there's the freedom for the imagination to roam.
Yes, I think so. And there is a precedent for this as well. If you go back to the beginning of the railroads around the world, it was definitely private investors who put the money up to build early railroads. What's shifted, I think, is that the politics and the economics are not the same. So if we get back to those challenges that I mentioned, for instance, the rights of way, if you were an early railroad baron trying to build your railroad across the country, it was easy to kind of, excuse the pun, but railroad through the system and just build your right of way wherever you wanted to. That's not so easy. You can't do that today. The other main problem, I think, for the private sector is that investors in new projects like transportation projects are really looking for a fairly quick return on their investment. And unfortunately, building transportation doesn't give you a quick return on investment. Possibly the way forward, and it's something that's been given a lot more thought to now in the US, and I know this comes out of a White House proposal as well, of public-private partnerships, or as some people call them, P3s. Essentially, it creates the best of both worlds where you can harness the private sector to come up with the visions and build these new ideas. But at the same time, using public coffers, you can guarantee that those private investors are going to get some of their money back. So here's the question I ask. I certainly believe that in this day and age, the fact that you cannot travel between San Francisco and Los Angeles by surface other than by car or an extremely slow train journey, I think, you know, that's preposterous. So we absolutely need a high-speed link. However, I would question the need to go quite so fast, because the general laws of physics suggest that the faster you go, the exponentially more difficult it is technically, and the more expensive it becomes.
That was Jeff Wardle. He's teacher of transportation systems and design at Art Center College of Design. Dan Sturges is an alumnus of Art Center who studied car design but wound up shunning cars. He's currently adjunct professor for transportation design at the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. But he joined us from a conference in Anaheim.
Overall, I think it's really exciting to see innovation happening in this area. At the same time, I think as a society, we're a bit confused about all this. And I think, like, when I think about the Hyperloop going 500, well, maybe actually 1,000 miles an hour, how fast they're talking about, you know, you could actually go from downtown Los Angeles to San Francisco in just 30 minutes. And that all sounds really fantastic. But when you really think about it, Southern California is such a mess with traffic. So, and can you imagine if we actually built something to go 30 minutes from downtown LA to San Francisco, but to go to Anaheim that night from downtown LA would take 2 hours or something. We need to focus, I think, on what we're trying to really achieve. What problem are we really trying to solve here? I would like to see the excitement for the Hyperloop translate into how we could actually get around better in the mega region of Southern California or Northern California or the Great Lakes, rather than thinking we can just go across the world for breakfast.
So you're saying that the Hyperloop is more like an airplane, but we're looking at turning an airplane tier of transit into something that we use just for going for lunch.
Yeah, well, we're all getting excited. I mean, that's kind of another thing that I'm a little bit not so sure about. I mean, I think we have a lot of problems with the environment right now, and it's because we as humans, or maybe as Americans, we all think we get it all. You know, we can get as big of a car as we want. We can use as much gas as we want. We can have it all. And because of that kind of mentality, we have a lot of problems.
That was Dan Sturges, a transportation strategist and teacher. And for Dan, the future lies in multimodal mobility. And that's exactly what the city of Santa Monica is trying to achieve with its network of Expo Line, Breeze Bikes, Big Blue Buses, and so on. The Expo Line opens this Friday. Metro will sweeten the deal with free rides on Friday and Saturday, and there'll be plenty of parties at various stations on Saturday. Find details at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up, does high school career tech offer a path to high-skilled jobs that won't leave kids drowning in debt?
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. We're in the City of Industry in the five-year-old 250,000-square-foot factory of a lighting company. It's called Troy Creative Systems Lighting, and it's one of the brands owned by veteran lighting company Litman. They have an identical, though larger, factory in the Philippines. There, 500 employees provide labor-intensive handcraft. Back here, 250 people are fabricating light fixtures that require a high level of precision. Steve Nadell is president of Troy CSL Lighting.
We're going the opposite of most everybody. Most everybody's moved their businesses offshore. We've tried to take more and more of it back here, only because, you know, rising wages in China and things like that have really made it not the most advantageous place to do business. And when you want to do custom lighting and specialty lighting, it's not possible in places like that. And that's why we're really in the Philippines, because it's a much more creative environment. There are certain things we can do there that are incredibly labor intensive that just don't make financial sense to do it here. What we're doing here is much more specialty skills, but things that require a lot more CNC equipment, automated equipment.
To find that combination of skills, meet Tommy Vargas. He started his career in sheet metal, but retrained along with several members of his family.
There's a lot of us. There's a lot of us, yes. I got my brother, two cousins, and my uncle. They're all machinists as me, just like me.
Do you like working with the machines? Is it interesting, or is it less manual and therefore you're not getting to actually make stuff yourself?
I would say it's more brain. So I have to actually troubleshoot the code, make a precise part down to the tenths of a thousandth of an inch. So say for instance there's 100 lights. I have to have all 100 exactly the same, so that I can get this part and put it with any other lamp and it'll fit, you know. So everything has to be precise.
So do you learn coding as part of the training?
Coding part of the training, yes. Editing the programs, troubleshooting, maintenance of the machines. If something goes wrong, what can I do to keep production going? Every aspect of the manufacturing business, you learn, and actually with experience, it also does the same.
Did you all train locally?
Yes, we did. We went to a school called NTMA. It's out of Santa Fe Springs to teach you specifically CNC machines, how to operate, how to program, and stuff like that.
Now, one hears a lot of talk at, I guess, legislative levels. You hear from policymakers about keeping these skilled, high-skilled jobs in the U.S. Is an institution like NTMA, do you think, making a contribution to that?
Yes, it is. I would actually say that a lot of states in the Midwest and the East Coast, you learn this in high school shop. You learn a lot of it. The conventional, the fabrication, hands-on, you'll learn in high school. California, we don't for our high schools. They took that out a few years back. You know, 10, 15 years back for the cuts and whatnot. So that affects people out of high school.
That's Tommy Vargas with Litman Brands Lighting. It turns out things are changing in high schools in California. Let's head now to Van Nuys. As part of our series on modern trades, we wanted to find out how high schoolers are being prepared for the kinds of high-tech manufacturing jobs that Tommy Vargas is doing. David Avalos is a junior at Van Nuys High School. He has bleach blonde hair, a scruffy beard and glasses. He's operating a CNC mill. And when he started working in the machine class, he says he really didn't expect to like it.
Well, I thought it was weird because you were just kind of cutting metal. And I didn't see like the whole point. Like my first project was a hammer. And it's kind of weird when you first get it because it's just like a little like cylinder block. But then the more you cut, the more like it starts to look like a hammer. And this is really cool to see yourself actually make something that you use. Like, I used a hammer, like, at my own house to, like, hang up stuff, like, nail down stuff. And this is, like, it's really rewarding to me.
Machining is just one of the so-called career tech programs at Van Nuys High. Career tech, or career technical education, is today's version of what used to be called shop. It involves preparing for jobs in trades as well as in the medical field. It also includes computer science and culinary arts. Recently, the state legislature passed a bill that would allow students to continue to take career technical education, also known as CTE courses, in order to meet high school graduation requirements. Set to sunset next year, this continues now to 2022. The author of the bill was Democratic State Senator Connie Laver.
I'm just a really big fan of career technical education. I think that we really are missing a whole sector of our young people, and I feel like this is something that will help make sure we're reaching out to them. We've got to give our young people as many paths to success as possible, and I've always felt that career tech was one of those.
Why has there been a decline in career tech, do you think, over the past 10, 20, even 30 years?
So I think it's a couple of things. One, I would say we have not funded to the degree that we need to shop or sewing or metalworks or woodworking in our high schools. We've seen a lot of those go away when the budgets got tight. I think those are the things that we cut along with art and music. But I also just truly believe that somehow we changed our focus as a society and just talk to everybody about going to college and getting a four-year degree. So I think we can do both. Instead of just focusing on one or the other, we can be multitaskers and give our students the opportunity to do what fits them best.
That was State Senator Connie Laver. Back at Van Nuys High School, we spoke with Principal Yolanda Gardia.
We talk about being college and career ready. Going to the university and getting $200,000 in debt and having a philosophy major, it makes you smarter. I mean, and no one says that that is not the case, but you are not career ready. And there's jobs for philosophers these days. There's a lot of kids out there who are just really bright. They want to do things with their hands. They want to create. Kids leave Van Nuys High School with certifications in automotive, in machining, and then they can go get a job that is making $18 or $20 an hour.
Principal Gardia says the school works with local businesses and industry leaders to create internships for the students and to meet the business's hiring needs.
We are part of the National Tooling and Machining Association of the San Fernando Valley. I go to meetings with them 6 o'clock in the morning, and they, as a group of businessmen, are investing in education for, you know, to help kids, but they're selfishly trying to find qualified people. They're going to lose a lot of employees in the next year or so. Most of their employees are in their 60s, and they're really it's a difficult, high-skilled, precise job that takes high-level math to be able to do it. And so it's a serious problem for them with building planes, amusement parks, all the different things that happen. I mean, every little part that for everything is there's something machined for it. And so someone has to be able to make it and has to be perfect. So yes, it's a serious predicament. And I'm very proud that at Van Nuys, we are getting our kids ready to go into the job market in our area and help fulfill some of these needs.
Next, we were taken into a garage-like space with a car jacked up for students to learn how engines work. Now, this seemed like typical shop, till you go upstairs and find a classroom filled with computers. Joseph Aguso has been teaching automotive classes at Van Nuys High for a dozen years.
The old school shop was, okay, you're going to change oil, you're going to change tires, and now cars are a lot more complex than what they were years ago. You know, the computers talking to each other. I mean, there's up to 40 or 50 different computers that basically communicate with each other. So when you hit a button on your radio, you know, it goes to a computer, and the computer actually selects the program that you're interested in. Or if you hit an unlock button on your door switch, it goes to a body control module. And then so that all the computer and all the technology is a lot more advanced than it was years ago. So the kids have to be highly developed in their skills to actually go out into the employment.
10th grader Jasmine Benitez wants to be a mechanical engineer. She's also taking an engine repair class at Pierce Community College in Woodland Hills and an automotive class at UCLA. She's also getting certified in automotive diagnostics.
Things like that help us in life. So that's just increasing our chances of getting hired quicker because we're starting from an early pace. You know, enrolling ourselves and doing all these extra courses and classes is helping us, but it depends on when you start and what you plan on doing. So you have to decide now from an early start.
Another student in automotive is Alejandro Martinez. He's a senior and he wants to work as an automotive technician at a dealership while continuing his studies. Last year, he and a partner won first place in regional and state automotive contests. They were flown to New York City to participate in the National Automotive Technology Competition, where they placed fifth nationally.
It was amazing. All the food we ate, what we saw. At one point, we had like a $700 dinner for like five people. It's amazing. Giant steaks, you know, $100 steaks. It's crazy. Yeah.
And that was for you and the other winners, or?
Yeah, it was for me and my partner.
What
What did you actually have to do to win this prize? Did you have to stand up on a stage and be quizzed, or did you have to make something?
There's actually 2 days of the competition. The first day is just different stations where you have to know the basic knowledge on cars, on automotive, but it's kind of like advanced knowledge. And the second day, you actually work on a car. They put about like 30 problems inside of the car. You have to figure out what the problems are and fix them in less than 3 hours.
Joseph Agrusso stresses that his class prepares students for a variety of jobs, not just fixing cars.
We got planes, trains, boats. We got all kinds of things that kind of revolve around the automotive industry. So my job is to open up their eyes through career exploration, and they can kind of see which pathway that they're interested in, whether it's engineering, whether it's design. You know, maybe they want to be a manager or a service advisor in this industry. So through all the different career paths, I open up their eyes to which direction they can go.
So where does the money come from to pay for all this?
Four of the double cheese and sausage. Right here, dude.
Yes, that's Sean Penn, a.k.a. Jeff Spicoli, getting a pizza delivered in class in fast times at Ridgemont High. The classic 80s movie used Van Nuys High School as a shooting location. So did the horror films Christine and Sleepwalkers. And lots of TV shows, The Wonder Years, Scrubs, Twin Peaks, as well as music videos and commercials. And that all means revenue for the school. For other schools, it's tougher. However, they can get money through Perkins funding. That's a federal grant distributed to states and districts. And having cut funding for shop class for many years, now the LA Unified School District is making more money available for career tech. Seema Puri is the CTE coordinator for LAUSD.
We have just received a grant to increase the number of CTE programs in our district for $32 million from the state. So we have a model here right now, but we want to create more CTE programs to this level. There is great need, and people understand that these programs open doors for the students, provide them various opportunities, various pathways. So these students can either go to college, four-year universities, or community colleges, or go straight into the career pathways.
Even though there is heightened interest in career tech, the pressure to go to college means there's still a stigma attached to vocational training. Principal Gardia would like to see that go away.
When I was going to school, I'm going to be 55 years old. Auto shop was for the thug kind of kids. And, you know, it's the kids who aren't smart. And we think you're not going to college, so we're going to put you in the, you know, the cooking class or the sewing class or the, you know, that kind of thing. And we need to get that stigma off of it, because they need to understand that this is a solid career pathway that will earn you a really great living, even better than going to college, with no student loan at the end.
And for David Avalos, taking machine classes actually made high school fun.
My whole experience of high school so far is, one of them is being in this classroom. I don't know, I really love being in this classroom. It's just rewarding.
Might career tech make sense for you or your family members? Find out more about it this Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon at a CTE showcase at Eagle Rock High School. It's free and everyone is welcome. Get details as well as more stories in our Modern Trade series at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. It was mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening.